Here's a New York Times headline that caught our eye a few weeks ago. My time as a hostage, and I'm a business reporter. Well, that business reporter is my guest, David Barboza. He covers China for the Times. He was visiting a Chinese factory complex, trying to interview the manufacturer of a toy that had been recalled because of lead paint. But instead of getting the interview, he was accused of being a spy and was held hostage for 9 hours, along with a photographer and translator. Barboza has been covering stories related to the tainted goods that have been exported from China, including toxic toys and pet food. He's also contributing to the Times' ongoing series called China Choking on Growth. I spoke with him during his current visit to the U.S. Barboza says one of the many reasons he was surprised to be held hostage is that he'd become used to being treated like a dignitary when he visited Chinese factories.
I think that's just generally the culture in China, that when foreigners come for interviews, and many of the times I was treated as a dignitary, these are state-owned companies. And state-owned companies kind of operate a little like the state. So as if I'm going in and meeting Hu Jintao or, you know, the president or the prime minister, they sit you in this big room and they bring out tea and there's a lot of welcoming remarks, and it's a long time before you actually get to an interview. That's a lot more welcoming than someone going and writing about political matters for business. The Chinese want to do business with Americans, with Europeans, and so they want to welcome the foreign media who's writing about business. It was very easy for me to get a visa, a journalist visa in China, and I think that's one of the reasons.
So what were you investigating when you were held hostage in the toy factory?
I had gotten a call a day before asking if I would go to a toy factory in southern China, in Dongguan, I would believe it was. And I was supposed to be investigating where the lead paint came from in a toy recall case that had happened that week. There was a very popular toy called Thomas and Friends toy railway sets, and I have to admit that I had not even heard of this. I don't have children yet, but my editors had heard about this, and it was a major recall. The factories, you have to know that factories in China are all sort of guarded compounds. They are, you know, they house dormitories for the workers. They house, you know, lots of factory places, maybe a shop, and they have these iron gates that electronically slide closed. And so it's not easy to get into the factory grounds. But for some reason at this factory, all 50 of their security guards were asleep the night we showed up. We showed up, I believe, on a Sunday night after 8 o'clock. It took us that long to actually find the factory. And when we drove up to it, we were stopped by one of the guards, and they asked what we were doing. And we said, we're from the New York Times, and we're here to look at the factory. And they said, fine, just fill out this form and come on in. And so we drove in. I had myself, a translator, and a photographer, and we went into this big open area where lots of workers were milling around. And this is really like a college campus. I mean, a lot of these factories have people who are generally age 18 to 24, mostly women, and it looks like a college campus. So we drove into the basketball court, started interviewing people on the basketball court. You know, there were lots of security guards around, and we luckily found some of the people that worked in paint supply after about 5 minutes in this factory complex. So it was sort of very fortunate that we were able to get in so easily and interview people, and we weren't violating any rules because we had signed in, and we had actually, out in the open, were photographing and interviewing people, and we were a little surprised that no one stopped us, but, you know, we kept going.
So did you find out anything about the use of lead paint in this factory before you were accused of being a spy?
At the end of those interviews, we only knew where the paint was going, where the painting was taking place in that big complex. And we knew what the workers made, how much they earned, how long the hours were. We got a good sense of the factory, but we didn't, you know, solve our main question, which was, is lead paint being intentionally applied to these toys?
Okay, so you left the factory on Sunday. It was the following day that the security guards decided to detain you. Why? What happened on Monday that made them suspicious of you when you returned?
I think when we started taking photographs and in trying to interview workers, they got very suspicious, and the managers really didn't know what was going on. And so they called one of the factory bosses in and set us up in a room for about an hour. And what I realized afterwards was that they were trying to figure out what to do with us. And when we decided we had been in that room for too long and that we were leaving, they then, the manager or the boss of this factory actually arrived and talked to us and actually gave us a hard time for coming onto the factory grounds and said we had broken the law by entering the factory. And I said, no, we had signed in. And he decided that he was going to take us to his little villa and have a discussion with us. And then he was going to give us a tour of this factory. But in fact, he was detaining us. And he would detain us for the next 9 hours because he believed we had broken into his factory. We had done things illegally by taking photographs of his workplace. And I think he was determined to get those photographs and to figure out whether we were actually spies.
How did you get out?
Well, we negotiated for hours. And if you've been to China, you know that negotiation is everything. There's negotiation over buying things on the streets, on getting a taxi. And we had to negotiate with government officials who were called in. And in fact, we called the police and the government in to try to rescue us from the factory because the factory claimed it was calling the police and the government, but it wasn't. And so when the government officials eventually came, following the police officials, they also had to negotiate with this factory to get our release. And it was only after 3 or 4 hours of negotiation where I conceded that I would write one sentence that they agreed to sort of let us go.
What was the sentence?
The sentence was something like, I agree that it is not true that this factory asked me to come and visit them and take photographs. Something to that effect, that basically they did not know we were going to be visiting the factory and taking photographs.
And that's true. They didn't know.
They didn't. So I felt that it was fine for me to do that. And if that's all it would take for me to get out of here after 6 or 7 hours, I was willing to write that sentence, but I was also very nervous about what I would write down and whether I would start writing, because pretty soon maybe they would request that I write other things. And in fact, they did.
And
I was so frustrated, I just said to them, look, I am being held hostage. I am not writing anything. This is not a torture session. I wrote the sentence that you wanted. I am not writing anything any longer.
And they let you go?
They didn't. They debated it. They faxed this letter to some other factory bosses who were out of town. And then after more and more negotiation, they agreed to send us to the police station to write a written statement of what happened that day. And then after writing that statement at something like 1 or 2 in the morning, after the New York Times editors called me and I told them that we're going to complain to the U.S. Embassy, then they started to believe that they had to let us go, and they released us that night.
In this whole experience, what did you learn about the power structure in China and the relationship of the factory bosses to the government, to the police?
You know, while this was taking place, I really didn't think of this in any terms of a story. I thought this is just one of the hassles that takes place in China as you're trying to pursue a story. But later on, I realized that this is really a window into the power structure in China, that when the police arrived at that factory, they had absolutely no power. And they talked to the factory bosses about letting us go, and the factory bosses said no. And then another line of police came, and they were told no. And they listened to both sides, and they had nothing to do. And then when the government came, the government couldn't release us from that factory. It was only after hours of negotiation and compromise that we could get out. So I think I realized that something I'd been seeing all along in China for the last couple of years is that the government really doesn't have total control over local officials and factory officials, that there is a very complex set of negotiations that needs to take place and a hierarchy to the regional areas and the factory areas. And I had to understand that, and that was at the heart of this situation, that the government and whoever's interest was in place there had to find a way to negotiate it.
My guest is David Barboza, and he's the New York Times Shanghai business and cultural correspondent. He's in the United States on a brief visit. So let's look at some of the larger problems in China now in terms of the manufacturing. I mean, as you're right, China accounts for 95% of all the toy recalls so far this year. And many of those recalls are because of lead paint. And, you've very recently written about lead paint problems in China. Why is there so much lead paint in China? I mean, do the people behind it know what kind of problems, you know, how toxic lead paint is?
I think in some cases they know, in some cases they don't know. But to understand that story, you have to understand that China is growing at a blistering pace. And everyone is setting up factories and making deals. And also many of these factories are trying to come in with low costs so that they can please the big corporations of America or Europe, the big retailers. And often those American and European companies go to these factories and say, we will make a deal with you to buy so many products next year, but you have to cut prices. This is what we want to see you come in at. And so in this big scramble to set up the factories, to meet the requirements, to please the retailers, to lower the cost, a lot of factory owners are cutting corners. They don't always know the consequences of cutting these corners, but it's rampant through China. This is really not a new story. There's counterfeiting all across China, and there's cutting of corners and putting in ingredients that aren't supposed to be there.
Let's get to the pet food recalls. There was a substance called melamine that was in a lot of the pet food. Like, what is that substance, and what's your understanding of why it had been in so much of the pet food that was exported?
Right. Well, melamine is a little like urea, and going way back in the United States, actually, agricultural farmers used to occasionally put urea and some of these high-protein sort of ingredients into their food supply to sort of boost the protein count. And I don't know how they came up with melamine. I mean, melamine actually comes originally from coal in China, and it's an industrial chemical. But someone in China realized that melamine was very much like urea, and people didn't test for it, and it did the same thing that urea had done in the United States in the 1920s and 30s. It would send the protein count higher. And so, in other words, you would think that you're getting high-protein corn or high-protein meal, but actually they would put in very low-protein corn or meal. But it would seem, because of the small bit of melamine, to be very strong in protein. And so when someone figured this out, they started putting it in pet food ingredients.
And do you think the people behind that knew how toxic the melamine could be?
I don't. Basically, I think the companies using melamine didn't realize that melamine, when it mixes with other like chemicals, can create a sort of toxic potion. And that's only what scientists found out later. So when they did this mixture, maybe by accident, they created something that was really potent. And when that got into the pet food, that created the problem.
How does this affect you as a consumer when you're in the United States buying cheap products that you know are manufactured in China?
Well, I'm actually trying not to buy many of those cheap products. I mean, not really that intentionally that I'm trying to send a message, but I just think that, you have to think twice about some of these goods, whether there's just... If you visit many factories, you'll just see how big the production is. It's sort of like when I've gone to, slaughterhouses, and I have to think twice about eating pork. I mean, it's just an amazing thing to see how much material is coming through the factory, how much chemical waste there is in these factories, the toxic fumes, the conditions. So you kind of almost feel after you've visited a lot of these factories that maybe you don't want to consume so much. Maybe there's too much consumption going on in the world. And maybe people are demanding prices that are too low. that they cannot comply with the laws in China. And one of the thoughts that I have in visiting these factories is, you know, nothing is free. And if you're not paying on this side of the ocean, someone is paying in China. If they're not complying with environmental regulations or labor regulations, they're eventually going to pay as far as health costs and environmental costs and other things. So I think visiting factories or visiting China makes you think differently about being a consumer.
David Barboza, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Glad to be with you.
David Barboza writes about business and culture in China for the New York Times and is contributing to the Times series about China, Choking on Growth.